So the point that we wanted to make is that before we have seen an example of F-term moduli space, okay? And let me remind you that in order for us to have a supersymmetric vacuum, both the F-terms and D-terms must vanish. And so what we did, we started discussing an example where we have a D-term moduli space. So specifically, the model that we looked at was a model where we had a U1 vector multiply, which means that what we had a vector boson, and we had its super partner, which is Fortino. And then we also had two chiral multiplets. So we had phi plus, q equals plus one chiral superfield, where plus one is a charge under the U1 symmetry corresponding to a mu. And then there is another vector multiplet, which has a charge minus one, also a chiral superfield. And so in this model, we looked at a simple, so we looked at this model classically. So there is a classical Keller potential. It takes form phi plus bar, e to the plus v phi plus phi minus bar, e to the minus v phi minus. So this is what we have seen before in the Vesumino model. And the only difference is the insertion of exponential of a vector multiplet. And the reason to do that is to restore gauge invariance, right? So this is needed for a U1 gauge invariance. So, and then in the models that we looked at, well, so actually in principle, there is one more term, which is a Fayette-Lenopoulos term, right? And so in principle, there is so this kinetic term, and there is also a potential term. So potential term is just a superpotential due to 16 pi I W alpha. So this is just actually a kinetic term for U1 multiplet. So this is kinetic term for a U1 multiplet. And then in principle, there could have been a superpotential. And gauge invariance requires that the superpotential must be a function of pi plus pi minus. Yes.
Do you always need to write only Keller potential in the diagonal form?
No, no. So this is just the simplest. This is just the simplest case, right? So in nonlinear sigma model, it can be anything. And remember that when we discuss an invariance, if you start with an arbitrary Keller potential, then I can always make it gauge invariant by inserting each of the qv here.
Are you sure? I mean, if the fields have different charge?
Sorry?
If the fields have different charge.
No, no, no. See, the thing is that I must have a global symmetry.
Yes.
Right? And then the statement is, so let me just be, so that I will insert it in the right place. Just 1 second. I want to write something. Okay, so you guys have to look at the notes. I don't think I have those notes with me now. So it's just logistics. So the thing is that so you have an arbitrary function to begin with in a nonlinear sigma model, and then you look at the symmetry, right? So what kind of symmetry it has? So in principle, it can have a bunch of U1 symmetries. So it can have a bunch of global symmetries such that phi I goes to e to the minus I lambda A q A I phi I, right? So A is an index that transfers a set of U1s. Yes. And so for each of
for each of a U1, my field phi I have a charge, which is QA sub I. Now, I can do in principle rotations. I can do rotations with respect to independently any of the U1s. So the thing is that the statement is the following. So if I have really a global symmetry, and I must have a global symmetry before I gain, right? So then my potential, my cal potential is invariant under this transformation, right? So which means that k of phi a phi I is the same as k phi I hat into the I lambda a u a I, and then I have phi I equals a minus I lambda a q a I.
So then you write V as a matrix.
Right. So because V will transform. Well, see, this thing must be true. So this statement is correct for arbitrary lambda a, right? So it's correct for arbitrary phases. So now once we go to supersymmetric gauge fields, then this guy is promoted to a parallel superfield lambda a. And this guy, everything, it would have been done automatically if this guy would be promoted to the same lambda a. But unfortunately, we cannot do that because this was a chiral superfield. This is a chiral superfield. I cannot shift an anti-chiral superfield by a chiral superfield. So what I need to do, I need to promote this to an anti-chiral superfield. Okay? If this would be without a hat, then this thing would guarantee me that it will be invariant under, would be invariant under rotations. Right? If it would be identical. Yeah. It's exactly the same as if I have a potential term, and that potential term is invariant under U1 transformations, then I can make those transformations local.
Yeah, sure, but I was just worried if you write down in terms of the exponential of E.
Well, but now what I was trying to tell you is that now things are a little bit subtle because those are two different fields. And that's precisely that what we need to do in order to make our Keller potential invariant under local transformations is that we will make it like this, right? E to the QA V sub A phi I. So then the vector fields V sub A, right? So V sub A will get transformed plus I. I don't remember exactly now my notation, right? But so up to sign, something like that. And so this difference will precisely take care of the fact that those one was chiral, the other was anti-chiral. And so you will end up back to this identity.
But not if you have like orthogonal terms. If you have like
no, even if I have orthogonal terms, it doesn't matter. It's the same thing. Remember that the only subtlety can be if I have derivatives inside the Keller potential, and I'm assuming that I don't. So this exactly the same thing was here. I have, for example, a mass term. Mij phi r phi j. Yeah. And the question is, when can I make a gauge invariant and when I cannot? Yeah. So the only way I can make this term gauge invariant, so this is an orthogonal term. So such term is present if I have some U1 symmetry. If qi plus qj equals to zero.
Yes. Yes,
so what I'm saying is that you might have orthogonal terms before, but whatever they are present, they will determine you what global symmetries you have. Some of the global symmetries might be disallowed. For example, if you have qi plus qj is not equal to zero, and you have mij is not equal to zero, then you just don't have this global symmetry, period. And all I'm saying is that before we start doing local symmetries, right, so we first have to identify all the global u1s. And that guarantees that this my Keller potential is invariant, wherever it is. I don't care what the function is. But the next thing is that once it's invariant under this, because I don't have any derivative, I can think of this as being a function of x, which is equivalent of thinking of them as being just lambda, if you wish, the whole field. And then the only subtlety is the subtlety that I just explained, that I cannot shift anti-chiral superfield by a chiral phase. But that's been taken care of by inserting this e to the v.
Very good. So we are happy.
Good. So so then there is this superpotential, and then there is a kinetic term, right? So this is superpotential. And so actually, this model is a good toy model for you to check. So for example, if the superpotential is just m phi plus phi minus, right? So this is exactly the model that Shamit mentioned to you before. This is a phi Epsilonopoulos model. And so you will find out that if m is not equal to 0 and k is not equal to 0, so you will find out the F term equations of motion, right? So the F term and D term, and you will find out that you cannot solve them. You cannot solve them simultaneously. Actually, let me just do this so that rather than talking in general, we'll just do it. Okay, it's not. So let's suppose we have this situation. Okay, so what we need to do. We need to recall what the D terms are, right? So the F terms we all remember, right? So there is an F term corresponding to field phi plus, and an F term corresponding to field phi minus, so f bar plus, I have to take w over del phi plus, and this will give me phi bar plus. And so in this case, we can see that this will be m phi minus, right? And I'm not going to write down the complex conjugate. So this is del w over del phi minus, which will give me phi plus. So those are the F terms. And in order for me to have a supersymmetric vacuum, remember a scalar potential, right? A scalar potential was the sum F squared, okay? So actually the coefficient here is 1. The coefficient here I don't remember now, but it was something positive, and it was D squared, right? And a D term is just minus e squared, and here I have k plus 1/2 q sub I. So this is in general, this expression is a general expression, what the D term will look like for a U1 if I have a set of chiral superfields with charges q sub I. So right, so in our case, this is just minus e squared k plus 1/2 absolute value phi plus squared minus 1/2 absolute value phi minus squared. And as I told you, that a condition for having a supersymmetric vacuum is that D terms must be equal to 0 as well. But you can see immediately that this condition is incompatible with the F term condition. Okay? The reason for that is that if M is not equal to 0, then the only solution for these two equations is that phi minus and phi plus equal to 0. Right? That's the only possibility for me to solve the F term equations. But then, if that is the case, then what I see that I cannot solve the D-term equation, right? So what I have is that D is going to be equal minus E squared times K, where K was this phi Epsilonopoulos term. And so unless this is actually the statement that they made here. So unless K equals to 0, then we have a spontaneous supersymmetry breaking. our model does not have a supersymmetric ground state. And you can see that that will always happen whenever one of them, for example, if I have m equal to 0, I can have a supersymmetric ground state. Okay, so let me just summarize. So this is the simplest model in which we have a supersymmetry, spontaneous supersymmetry breaking. So if m equals 0 and k is not equal to 0, then I can have a supersymmetric ground state, right? So then the only condition I have, the F terms are trivially satisfied, and the only condition is D equal to 0, which I can, again, trivially, which I can satisfy because I can always find the solution to this equation, K plus 1/2 phi plus squared minus 1/2 phi minus squared equal to 0. Right? So this equation will always have a solution. In fact, there will be more than one solution. There will be a whole moduli space of solutions. Okay, so in this case, we have a SUSY vacuum. Right. So actually, we have to be a little bit careful about moduli space in this case. But, we will find out if we are more careful. There is no moduli space. If we have a situation like this, right, then we also have a SUSY vacuum. It's an isolated vacuum. So in this case, we have, again a SUSY vacuum. And that SUSY vacuum is at phi plus phi minus equal to 0. I still have to solve the F term equations, but then the D term equations will be solved automatically, okay? And this is actually an example, if you wish. This is an example of something that I said always happens. So if you can solve F term, you can always solve D term equation. So there is actually a theorem you can prove that that's always the case, all right? And so the final situation is the one that we actually discussed on the blackboard, right? So this is an example of the simplest model in which there is SUSY breaking. Okay. Right. So what we didn't talk about this, but what we discussed in the context of this model is that. Is that there is a moduli space coming from D terms, and so there is a moduli space. This happens when phi at the Lyapunov term equals to 0, right? And also we looked, we said that there will be a moduli term when there is no superpotential. So the only condition we have on our SUSY vacuum is vanishing of the D terms, and that leads us to a condition phi plus absolute value equals to phi minus. And so we can solve this condition in all generality. And so that implies that phi plus equals phi minus up to some phase. Okay? On the other hand, as usual, what we're interested in, gauging equivalent vacuum. And the point of the last time discussion was that alpha is actually a gauge artifact, right? Because under U1 transformation, those two fields rotate in a different way. I can always do a U1 transformation to kill alpha, right? So a U1 gauge transformation, can be used to set alpha equal to 0. So that's where we ended last time, and I wanted to make a couple comments. So if we do that, then this suggests that moduli space is simply phi plus equals to phi minus. However, However, that's not quite true. And the reason for that it's not quite true, because I can do the gauge transformation does not, so there is, there are still residual gauge transformation, right? So so this is a condition for vanishing of D terms. And if we rotate with U1, so if phi plus goes to phi plus e to the minus I pi, right? So if it's rotated by pi, then necessarily phi minus will be rotated to plus I pi. So we will get an identical field configuration, right? Because and moreover, this transformation preserves our gauge fixing condition. The important thing is that this rotation will preserve the condition. What we think is our moduli space is phi plus equals to phi minus. And moreover, so it preserves the rotation of this type will preserve this condition. So it must lead to gauge equivalent vacuum, right? So in other words, because that's a U1 transformation, phi plus and phi minus must be gauge equivalent to phi plus e to the minus I pi and phi minus e to the plus I pi. So what we are finding that actually on our moduli space, there is an identification. So a rotation by pi is just a reflection. So what we actually are finding is that our moduli space is an orbifold, right? So it's so moduli space. So moduli space is just a space of phi plus modded out by a discrete Z2 transformation, which moves, which identifies phi plus with minus phi plus. So typically identifications on the moduli space, discrete identifications like this, if they have fixed points, they will lead to a singularity. And so this is what I want to show you. So just a general fact, discrete identifications with fixed points typically lead to singularities, okay? Leads to singularities. Usually, it's known as orbifold singularities, because by orbifold we mean a gauge, a discrete, a group of identification, a discrete group of identifications. So, right. So first of all, let's see that here we have a fixed point, right? So the fixed point phi plus goes to phi minus, it leaves an invariant phi plus equal to zero. So an origin of a field space is a fixed point of that identification. And actually, this is, as I said, a Z2 or default fixed point. But we can actually be rigorous and show that there is a singularity there. And in order for us to do that, what we have to do is to look at the metric on the moduli space and show that there is a singularity at the origin. So how we can do that? Well, so we can introduce a gauge invariant coordinate, right? So on a moduli space, So I'm going to define M equals phi plus, phi minus. So it's clearly gauge invariant. And so once you give me a value of M, I will produce you a unique point in the moduli space, right? So the moduli space is defined by a set of phi plus, phi minus equals 2 phi plus, up to a Z2 identification. So clearly, given M produces a unique phi plus, phi minus up to this identification where I have a reflection. Now, once we realize that, we can just look what our moduli space looks like. Right, so a Keller potential, a classical Keller potential that I would write down would take this form. Now, once I restrict, once I go to the moduli space, so once we restrict to the moduli space, so what we will have is that phi plus is the same as phi minus up to this, that up to simultaneous reflection. So on a moduli space, a Keller potential takes this form. So I have a factor of 2. And I can write it down in terms of, I can write it down in terms of this M variable, right? So this is 2 root mm bar. Let's see. Right, so M is a chiral superfield, and corresponding M bar is an anti-chiral. Right. So now once we have this moduli space, we can compute, we have a Keller potential written in terms of a gauge invariant coordinate on the moduli space. We can figure out what is the metric on the moduli space. Ds squared equals del 2k over del del M over del M bar, dm bar, right? So that's an expression how we evaluate metric on a Keller manifold. And so if we do the algebra here, right, so we have an explicit expression for the Keller potential. We have the formula. So we'll find out that the metric on the moduli space takes this form. Okay, and so indeed, you can see that there is a metric becomes singular at the origin of the moduli space, right? So there is a singularity at m equal to 0. Notice that that's a distinct singularity compared to the singularities we discussed before. So before what we studied a model in which there was a completely smooth moduli space. And then we looked at the quantum corrections, and we found that quantum corrections produced a singular metric. So here, here we actually see a singular classical moduli space. But this is, this, if you wish, much simpler type of singularity. And this singularity is simply associated with the difficulty of introducing a nice set of coordinates on the moduli space. So we can go ahead in this model and we can compute corrections. Okay, and so the moduli space will receive quantum corrections. So metric on the moduli space. Again, notice that this is a D term moduli space, not the F term moduli space. So metric on the moduli space would receive quantum corrections. I'm not going to write it down, but we will discuss in details. Actually, subtleties how we set up the metric on the moduli space and what kind of singularity. It's actually exactly the same type singularity as would arise in this model. The ones that will show up in Cyber-Whitten solution that we're going to study probably late, start studying it at the end of next week. But there will be a quantum corrections, and there will be a singularity. There will be a singularity, worse singularity, at the origin of the moduli space at this orbifold singularity. So there will be a singularity similar similar to a singularity in lambda phi cube. So when, remember, we looked at the superpotential, which was W equals lambda phi cube, and there was a quantum singularity at the origin of the moduli space. So there will be a similar, there will be a similar singularity, and so the law is that once we have a singularity, there is a good reason for this singularity to be present there. And that is a signal to us that our effective field theory breaks down. Okay, so this is a message that I want you to take from the course. I mean, supersymmetry is good, but it's not, you know, it's not. I think the most important thing is that the idea of this low energy effective action and understanding what does it mean that the low energy effective action breaks down. So so the singularity, origin of the singularity would mean that our effective field theory breaks down, and typically in most all the cases that I'm aware, both in field theory and string theory, this is associated with additional massless states. So when I discussed this problem before in the context of Bazzumino model, there were two fields there. There was a singularity, and we understood why there was that singularity and what exactly the fields that become massless. So can somebody tell me why am I claiming that there will be a singularity very similar to the ones that we discussed?
How many of you guys are taking spontaneous symmetry breaking? Good. So what happens in field series when there is a spontaneous breaking of gauge symmetry?
Massive gauge
bosons. Right. So gauge bosons become massive. Very good. What is the sign of breaking a gauge symmetry? A charged field will develop a wave. But if I have a charged field, and if it develops a wave, then my gauge symmetry must be broken, which means that my gauge boson will be massive. That's, if you do analysis in this model, that's indeed what happens. Notice that we have a moduli space, and moduli space is characterized by the expectation value of phi plus and phi minus. So once we go from the origin of the moduli space, what will happen is that our photon, a mu, will develop a mass, and in fact, this mass will be roughly the coupling constant times the expectation value, of the field, exactly like in this Higgs phenomena that you guys are all studying in the class before. So now the answer to my question becomes trivial: what is the extra state that will become that will produce the singularity at the origin of the moduli space? It is precisely this vector multiple. Because once you go back to the origin, if you are away from the origin of the moduli space, then your vector boson is massive. And we excluded it from our effective field theory. Actually, nobody of you asked me, why in the world did I write down a Keller potential like that without a vector potential? Before, we were writing a Keller potential including e to the v and e to the minus v. The reason for that, as you can see, is that by writing it this way, I'm assuming that I'm writing down an effective field series for light degrees of freedom, and light degrees of freedom are phi plus and phi minus. Everywhere except at the origin, the vector multiplet is massive.
it gets masked by supersymmetric Higgs mechanism. And this description, so something that we'll study when we go back and discuss Zyberg-Witten model, this description breaks down precisely at the origin of the moduli space. Because at the origin of the moduli space, it is inconsistent for me to forget about the vector boson. It's inconsistent for me if you wish to draw up e to the v's there. All right, guys, so any questions?
So, sorry, can you explain again why the e to the v is dropped? Is it becomes negligible? Or?
No, it's just, you know, we write down the field theory including our light degrees of freedom. Okay, and so first of all, if I have a massive field, what is the rest of, what vacuum expectation value a massive field can get? Classically, it can get zero, right?
Yeah.
Because if I have a potential, if a massive field, it means that they have a curvature in the potential, right? And the possible expectation values is pretty much the extreme of the potential. I have isolated extrema, and it's at the origin of the field space. So you can think of the reason I dropped into the V is because everywhere except that at the origin of my moduli space, my vector multiplet is massive. And so it's I can write it down, but insert the expectation value of E. But the expectation value of E should be set to equal to zero. Because it's a massive field, you cannot get any vector. The only field, once we have a moduli space, by definition, our moduli are maskless fields. Right? So all these 5 plus and 5 minus, they are maskless fields. They never develop mass. All right, guys, so good. So we are done with E1, and what I'm going to do today, I want to talk about not abelian supersymmetric gate series first, just classical. And again, I'm just going to omit most of the technical details because, for one reason, you have already enough knowledge of supersymmetry in order to reproduce all those details. That's one reason. And second reason, I just don't have time. And hopefully, what I want to do, I want to start discussing quantum, non-abelian quantum field theories today. All right, so let's go. So the next topic, non-abelian gauge series. So I'm going to make an assumption that you have seen non-abelian gauge series. Have you? Okay. So we see non-abelian gauge series. Okay, so before we studied global symmetries, which were abelian U1, and we were gauging this global symmetry. So what we can do, we can start, for example, I will restrict to just unitary groups, but it can be done in general. So suppose my theory has a global symmetry, which we will gauge, and it's a unitary group. Group G, and so corresponding to this unitary group G, there is a Lie algebra, and so I'm just going to write down the generators of Lie algebra as T, right? So my Lie algebra is a commutator T A T B equals I F A B C. So here I have T C. Where there is FABC called structure constants. So, so you can think of this as a matrices, right? So they obviously don't commute. And first of all, the dimensionality of this matrix and the particular realization
of this Lie algebra will depend on which representation I am looking at. So in fact, one of the representation is when I think about T as being just a structure constant, right? And that will provide an adjoint adjoint realization of this Lie algebra. Okay, so so since we are thinking about this as a matrices, so we have to talk about how we normalize them. And so for now, we will talk about, we'll go back to this issue of how do we normalize generators of Lie algebra. But for now, I'm just gonna normalize it in this way, where by trace, I'm taking in whatever the representation are that's relevant for the discussion. Okay, so so before our gauge parameter was a phase, right, in the U1. So now now our gauge parameter, I call it lambda. So it becomes a Lie algebra valued object, right? So it's I can decompose it. So you can think of this as generators of TA form a complete basis, right? And so a gauge transformation, I can decompose in this basis, so it takes this form, right? This in principle is a function of X, and so this is our gauge parameter. Something that generalizes the phase in the case of a U1, and so much like in the case of abelian gauge theories, what we will do, we will promote this lambda to a chiral superfield. Right. So before it was just a real constant, and now it will become a chiral superfield, but it will be a matrix-valued chiral superfield. So it will take values in a certain representation of the Lie algebra, right? Chiral superfield valued valued in some representation R of our group G. And of course, depending which lambda we will use, if we have objects which are charged under different, are charged under different representations, then the non-abelian gauge transformations will be done with a corresponding lambda for them. Okay, so. So we start with a field phi, right? And so before, our chiral superfield was invariant under non-abelian transformation with this gauge parameter lambda. So now our chiral superfield will go to minus I lambda phi, right? So where lambda is a chiral superfield. So again, this if lambda would be just constant, right, so if it would be e to the minus I lambda a of x ta, right, some field phi, then this would be just a just your standard standard non-abelian gauge transformation on meta fields, right? So for the anti-chiral superfields, we're going to do exactly the same as we did before. So in addition to switching a sign here, we also have to replace lambda with lambda bar. That's an anti-chiral superfield now. And much like in the abelian case, yeah, if we start with a Keller potential, which was invariant under non-abelian transformations, right? Some global non-abelian group, then I can make a Keller potential invariant under local transformation, by again inserting by inserting e to the v. Okay, phi, where v is our vector superfield, but it is valid. It is valued in the adjoint representation of our group. The adjoint. Okay. Okay. So everything is exactly as we discussed before. So now we spend a lot of time of arguing that there is a Vezzumino gauge and that whenever we write down Lagrangian, it's invariant under general supersymmetric gauge transformations. Just one second. But ultimately, all the computations were done in the Vezzumino gauge. So I'm just going to do exactly, I'm going to skip all those arguments and just tell you that there is a analog of Vezzumino gauge. We will discuss it. And I'm not going to prove that it exists or that that's well defined. Yeah.
So it's a vector superfield value.
Yeah. So it's a vector superfield, but so this index A runs over the dimension of the adjoint representation, right? So if you were to have SU3, right, then your vector superfield would be if you could realize it as a 9x9 matrix, okay. And then you would decompose it into the representation in the adjoint representation of SU3. So those are traceless Hermitian matrices, right? And there are 8 of them. So that's the analog of that. You have 8 gluons. And so this index A in this case will run 1.
So why is that in the adjoint and the other one is just in an arbitrary R representation?
Because when we gauge the global symmetry, what will always happen that that the field that produces for us. So what does it mean gauging a symmetry? We have a global symmetry, meaning that we are rotating the field using this symmetry by exactly the same amount everywhere in space-time. Okay, so that's what it means, a global symmetry. Local symmetry means that we have an option of rotating our objects by different amounts at different points in the space-time. And it turns out that the object that would produce for us this rotation, in order for us to define this notation, is a gauge field. And it will always happen to be in the adjoint representation. So, I'm going to refer a lot to a book by Chen and Li. And so, I think it's chapter 9. So, it's a very nice discussion of non abelian gauge series in general. Though it will not answer your question. You're thinking, is there? No, I don't. Honestly, I don't have some simple explanation why there. Why it must be an adjoint representation.
I think maybe if you look at the covariant gauge parameter, T plus A, and then you look at that transformation e to the lambda. I think if you look at that, then you will see that if you write down that derivative, A needs to the gauge field needs to transform in the adjoint.
The structure constants. Is it the commute?
Pardon?
Is it because you have to commute the operators with the exponential map, and you get structure constants out? in the structure constants are in the adjoint?
Yes, structure constant transform in the adjoint representation, and our vector field will be in the adjoint representation. But so I guess, well, I don't know if is that useful with me? So that's one way. You can look at the fields in the fundamental representation, I have to define covariant derivative. I guess okay.
It makes sense, and it agrees with what I already know. I just wondered if there's a deeper reason, or there's some obvious thing.
Yeah, ultimately, I think Matt gave you the answer, because ultimately what we will be doing once we construct the gauge invariant object. So for now, we can say that we don't know in which representation this V will transform. And then we will construct a gauge invariant object, which will be a field strength. Okay? And then we can ask, it's almost the same what Matt was saying. And then we will ask is, what will be the transformation, what will be the transformation of the field strength under gauge transformation. It will transform covariant, right? So there will be it will transform in the adjoint representation. And so I think we would have to postulate that our vector potential lives in the adjoint representation.
I agree with the adjoint representation and the normal field theories, but it seems a little odd to me, because if V is in the adjoint representation, the dimension is fixed, but phi is an arbitrary dimension.
In arbitrary representation.
Yeah. So the arbitrary representation means that e to the v is not acting like it should be.
No, it does, because see, what you have is that this guy is in the representation R, so the complex conjugate of something will be in the representation R bar, mm-hmm. And so phi bar phi will be in a tensor product R bar R. And if you do this will be a reducible representation.
Yeah.
And if you decompose it, there will always be an adjoint there.
Okay.
So ultimately, your question is this object, so you're asking in a fancy way, is this object invariant under gauge transformations or not?
Yeah.
And the answer is yes.
Okay.
Right. In fact, this is something that. So this will be clear to Sean's question a little bit, because what we will do, we will actually discover what is the transformation, what is the gauge transformation corresponding to this V, and then we can ask. Okay, so we will figure out how exactly this the transform and the gauge transformation, and we will ask what representation is that. And it will transform exactly as fields in the adjoint representation would transform. Or in other words, how would fields transform if the generators, TA, would be just a structure constant of our Lie algebra. So this, but in my opinion, sort of a bit circular type of thing. So yeah. I mean, I don't have a big physical reason why it should be. All right, guys, we move on. Okay, so for now, so let's pretend that we don't know that. So that's in, again, some representation, right? It's not true that we don't know it, because actually, in order for this object to be invariant, what I have to say is that e to the v will transform precisely in the adjoint representation. E to the minus I lambda bar e to the v into the r lambda. Okay, so for now, if you wish, what we are doing, we are defining. So you can think of this here as a phi is a vector, right? So you can think of this as a quark,
and it has three components. right, charged on the SV3. So it's a it's a fundamental representation of the unitary group. And then there is some transformation here, right? So now what I wanna do, I wanna insert another field, a vector superfield. And I want to do it in such a way, I want to require that my whole Keller potential be invariant under gauge transformations. And gauge transformations, supersymmetric gauge transformations, we will define as just a direct extension of the abelian gauge transformation. And that tells us that our vector field must transform in this way. Okay, so I'm happy to stick with this, and then we will discover which representation our vector field must be. Okay, is the logic okay now? All right, good. So let's move on. So the only again, the only difference is that now V is just not a scalar, but it's a Lie algebra valued object. So the statement, remember what we did, we wrote the most general vector superfield, and then we started supersymmetric gauge transformation and showed that there is a Vezzemino gauge. And so the statement that I wanna do is that the Vezzemino gauge also possible here. So I'm not gonna prove this fact. Now remember that the property of the Vezzemino gauge, something that made that Vezzemino gauge very useful, was that if I cube the vector potential in Vezzemino gauge, I will get zero, okay? So what the Vezzemino gauge was useful is that e to the v takes a very simple form. It's actually a finite polynomial in the Vezzemino gauge. Now, another thing, remember that before, again, recall what you remember from abelian gauge series. Lambda was a chiral superfield. And so because it was a chiral superfield, it actually had it had a scalar alpha, right? It had a Weyl fermion psi. And it also had F term. Now, in order for us to fix the Vezzemino gauge, we had to tune Weyl fermions, we also had to tune. So alpha is complex. So in principle, there is real part of alpha, and there was also an imaginary part of alpha, right? And so, in order for us to fix the Vezzemino gauge in the abelian case, we had to tune the Weyl fermions of this SUSY gauge transformation to specific value. We had to tune F to specific value, and we had to tune the real part of this complex scalar to a specific value. So must be tuned to get Vezzemino gauge. So the only thing that was left, okay, so let me call it lambda, alpha hat here. So the only thing that was unfixed in the Vezzemino gauge is a single scalar, single real scalar of a chiral superfield. And that single scalar was providing ordinary gauge transformations, right? So in U1, what this unfixed scalar was doing, it was providing for us this transformation. Okay? So I'm gonna call this the imaginary part of a complex scalar in a chiral superfield. I'm just gonna call it alpha. That's why I had to change to alpha hat spot. So the statement is that exactly the same thing will happen once we go to non-abelian gauge theories. So what must be correct then is that in Vezzemino gauge, my gauge transformation chiral superfield takes a very specific form. So let me write it down. So in Vezzemino gauge, So it must depend only on a single real parameter. So it's alpha, right? Alpha plus I theta sigma mu theta bar L mu alpha plus a quarter theta squared theta bar squared L 2 alpha, where alpha is real. Well, okay, so it depends how I write down the adjoint representation. Anyway, it depends on one alpha, and this alpha takes values in the Lie algebra. So it's alpha A T A, and it's something that provides for us the residual gauge transformations that are not fixed once we go to the Schwarz-Zemino gauge. So now the next step, what we would like to do is, sitting in this Schwarz-Zemino gauge, we want to recover the non-abelian gauge transformations, right? So what we will do is, we want to compute infinitesimal gauge transformation. Okay. So alpha sub A are our gauge parameters, and so we're going to compute them up to order alpha A squared. Okay, just to linear order in this gauge transformation.
What you're saying is that in the non-abelian case, alphas take indices that they're now valued in. So, like,
before remember lambda? Lambda was lambda A T A.
Yeah.
Now, what I'm saying is that I'm going to a specific gauge in which I cut lots of components in this vector multiply. I cut those components in such a way that V cube equals to zero.
Right.
And once I do that, then there is, then out of the whole chiral superfields, the only thing that will be left is alpha. But this will not be a number. It will be because we started with so if you wish, from each lambda A, so I have the number of chiral superfields, as many as the dimension of the adjoint representation. So out of each chiral superfield, the only thing that will be left will be alpha A. And it will completely determine the, what my chiral superfield is.
So the things that you're specifying would be like an FA and a psi A, and then an alpha bar or something?
Yeah. It's exactly, the situation is exactly the same as it was in a U1 gauge theory, right? So before this was a chiral superfield, it had a complex scalar alpha hat, right? So that complex scalar has a real part and imaginary part, right? And additionally, it has a wild fermion, and it has the auxiliary component F, right? So in order for me to go to these gauge there, what I had to do, I had to tune those two guys to a specific level, and I also had to tune the real part of this complex scalar. So the one that was left unfixed was the imaginary part. And that imaginary part was providing for me the ordinary abelian gauge transformation. So I'm saying that exactly the same thing, because the only difference once we go from abelian to non-abelian, the only thing that will happen is that now all these fields will carry an index A. If you wish, for now, we don't even know in which representation they transform. The only thing we do know is that in order for our theory to be a gauge invariant, integrally must transform like that. And what I'm saying that there is an analog. It is also possible in non-abelian case to achieve this. And once I do that, then there will be out of this lambda, right? So lambda had, if you wish, lambda A and because this is an imaginary part, so say beta A. There,
It's a little bit hard for me to break because alpha is imaginary part of what was the scalar component. So beta A, and then there was phi A and F A. So all of those components will get fixed. Okay? So they are not independent anymore in a chiral superfield. And I gave you an explicit expression. How does my chiral superfield will look like? So it will look like this. Okay, so if you wish, I could have written here an index A. So I think the easiest for you is maybe to think that I have number of U1s, and the number of U1s is as many as the adjoint representation of the gauge. It's actually incorrect to think of them. So in that formula there, this is what I would have written in the abelian case as well. So the index A would be 1. Right, so this is, if I go to that minimum gauge, so this is exactly the same. So this would be Wells Minow gauge chiral superfield for U1. Okay? So that it was an unconstrained chiral superfield. Now if I go to a Wells Minow gauge, it will take a very specific form. The form it will take exactly that, except that there will be no index A there. So the only thing that happens once we go non-abelian is that there is an index A that runs some representation of the group. All right, guys, let's move on. So we are up now to our task, and that is computing infinitesimal gauge transformations. So okay, so very much like it was in the abelian case, I can evaluate what e to the v is going to be in our case. And it will take this form. So, well, it's 1 plus v plus 1/2 v squared. And if I substitute the values of v in this Wells-Minow gauge, then I will have 1 plus theta sigma mu theta bar a mu, and then I have plus I theta squared, theta bar squared, lambda bar, minus I, theta squared bar, theta lambda. And then I have plus 1/2, theta squared, theta bar squared. And then I have d minus a mu. Okay, so where Those objects are actually Lie algebra values. So when I write this, what I always mean, I mean this. Okay. So now we know how our vector potential transform under gauge transformations. And so we can ask, now we know from our intuition in the abelian case that in the Wells-Minow gauge, the only thing that is left is just ordinary gauge transformations. And so what we want to do, we want to ask, how does this guy transform under this transformation, right? So let me do this computation.
Okay, so V will get to V prime. And so, in fact, I have a relation 1 plus V prime plus 1 half V prime squared must be identical. So to leading order, I can just do a Taylor series expansion and keep linear terms in lambda bar lambda, right? So I will have 1 minus I lambda bar. Here I have 1 plus V plus 1 half V squared. Here I have 1 plus I lambda, right? And let's see. Unfortunately, my lambda is given up here. Okay. And so I have an explicit expression how I expect my transformation to look like. I know what lambda is. It's behind this blackboard, and I know the expansion for vector superfield in the Vezzemino gauge. So I can just collect appropriate terms, and I'm just going to write down the answer. So if I look at this term, theta sigma mu theta bar a mu prime, right? So I'm just looking at the second term up there. So it turns out that it will just this identity, as far as this term will trend, will depend, will turn into, again, this is a trivial exercise. You just have to write down the expansion and collect terms, but remembering that you always do keep terms only linear in alpha, okay? So what you will find out, so this is sigma mu, and then I have theta bar a mu minus theta sigma mu theta bar del mu alpha, okay? And then there is another term like that, del mu alpha. So the fact that there will be two contributions coming from two contributions of the same type, one will be from here, right? So this gives you a term like this, and another one will give you a term like this. So it turns out that they come with the same sign. And then finally, there will be a term when there will be this term here, okay? And then there will be, when you multiply, those are the terms that will be linear and coming from here as well. And so if you do your algebra carefully, you will find out that that will bring to additional contribution theta sigma mu theta bar. And here I will have a commutator of alpha a mu. Okay, and then as I said, so I just collected terms which are linear in alpha. So this is correct up to orders of alpha squared. So what this tells me, that my vector potential a mu goes to a mu prime, which is equal to a mu plus 2 del mu alpha plus I commutator alpha a mu. Okay, so this is in this matrix notation, and so I can write it down in components. Okay, so the only thing that I need to be careful about this term, so alpha a mu, what this means I have alpha a, and then I have a mu b, and then I have a commutator t a and t b, and so I can use my Lie algebra to write this down as I alpha a mu b f a b c t c. Okay, so once I do that, I can write down in component how does my vector potential transform. So a mu a go to a mu a prime, which is A mu A. And then there is just this term, which is sort of trivial, alpha A. And then that term just gives me minus FABC alpha B A mu C. Okay? And so it is this last term that tells me that we are in adjoint representation. Okay, so the structure the corresponding T matrices are actually the structure constants. Okay, and so as I said, so this is a standard definition of non-abelian gauge transformations. And so the best, I think it's section 9, section 9 in Chang and Lee. Okay, so we looked at the transformation for our vector potential, right? We can look at the transformation of the gauge, you know, right? So we have a Weyl fermion, which is a superpartner of the gauge boson. And I'm just going to give you the answer, what will happen. So in order for us to figure out how does the Weyl fermion transform a superpartner of gauge boson, we just look at this term, for example. Okay. So there is this term in the expansion of e to the v. And so just from this identity here, we will find out that it takes the form minus I theta bar squared theta, and then I have lambda minus I commutator of alpha lambda. Okay, and again, there is order alpha squared correction. So lambda prime, lambda will go to lambda prime, which is lambda minus I commutator alpha lambda. And so if I do it in components, then I will have that lambda A will go to lambda A prime, which is equal to lambda A plus FABC alpha B lambda C. So as we expect, both the gauge potential and its superpartner Weyl fermion transform in the same representation. So this is adjoint representation. Yeah, actually, what I said here is incorrect. It's section 8. More precisely, it's section 8.1. Okay. So you can read all these details, and by doing the computations that I just told you in a supersymmetric context, you will precisely reproduce the non-abelian gauge transformations as discussed in that. Okay, let's see. Yes.
Invariance under large gauge transformations.
Right. So, so under large gauge transformations, it will transform, as I told you, right? So, so it will go e to the v, will go e to the minus I lambda bar e to the v e to the I lambda. That's transformation under large gauge transformation.
So, it's possible to prove that.
Well, in some sense, we have to postulate that it will transform in this way, in order to have the invariance of the Keller potential. What is possible to prove is that this is actually the correct covariant transformation
if my object is in transformed. For example, we will derive this, that that's the way how the field strength transforms, right? And the transformation of the field strength, so if you look at this section, is discussed for finite gauge transformations, and we will reproduce exactly the same expression. Not for the, well, we will do this for the field strength. I lost my page somewhere. Okay, anyway. So, right. So just to be somewhat a bit concrete, let's go and for the SU2, for example, right? Right, so so again, from, for example, from Chen and Li, this is section 8.1. So he looks at a specific case when the group is SU2, and then the structure constant FABC is just actually ABC, completely anti-symmetric. So we can construct the field strengths, right, F mu nu A prime. So F mu A goes to F mu A prime plus epsilon A B C alpha B F C mu. So this is the standard adjoint infinitesimal transformation for the field strength in the adjoint representation, right? So this is infinitesimal. So it comes, it actually comes from a finite, so this answering some question. So that comes from, this infinitesimal transformation comes from the finite gauge transformation. So the finite gauge transformations is done by a matrix U, right? So for example, a unitary matrix we can always write down as exponential some gauge parameters lambda A is the adjoint representation, and T sub A are the generators of the Lie algebra. And so if we write it in this way, so what we do know is that if our object so lambda transforms into the adjoint representation in adjoint, so then under finite gauge transformations, this curly L will go to curly L prime, which is U curly L U minus 1. So that's a finite form of adjoint representation. And so I'm just going to talk for maybe 2-3 minutes, guys, and I just want to finish this gauge transformation business. So this is a finite form of the adjoint transformations. And so if we have infinitesimal, then U becomes 1 minus I alpha, we put alpha here as well. So
So I alpha A dA, okay? And alpha inverse is 1 plus I alpha A dA. If I put I, then my alphas are real numbers. And so to leading order in alpha, we can derive. So I guess I'm assuming here that you know the finite form of the gauge transformation, and I'm just deriving you what the infinitesimal gauge transformation will look like. So it will be L minus I commutator alpha L, right? So, and that will simply follow because I just look at this finite form. So L prime will be 1 minus I alpha, right? Then I have L, and then I have times 1 plus I alpha, right? And so I'm just opening this up and keeping terms linear in alpha. So I have L, and then I have minus I alpha L, and then I have plus I L alpha. Now alpha and L, they're actually Lie algebra valued objects. So I have minus I, and then I have commutator. And so this is the infinitesimal form that we've seen before. Right, so everything for the adjoint representation. Okay, so we showed that much like in the abelian case, once we go to the Zimino gauge, our non-abelian vector potential will have, our non-abelian vector multiplet will have a gauge potential, will have a gauge Gino, wild fermion lambda A, and it will have also an auxiliary term d sub A, much like in the abelian case. And all these objects, a mu, dA, and lambda A, so they are all transformed in adjoint representation. Okay? All right, guys, so we're done with infinitesimal gauge transformations, and I guess next week we will talk about the field strengths and writing down the supersymmetric Lagrangian. Unfortunately, we didn't have time to study quantum gauge theories yet.